welcome to Poet Runner. Today we have a special episode. We have Luis Rodriguez, who is running for governor, who's also the founder of Teochew Cultural Center, Teochew Press. He was our Los Angeles Poet Laureate. He does a lot of good things in prisons, helping people with poetry and stuff. And welcome, Luis.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to hear your voice.
Yep.
The first question I'd like to ask is, in your run for governor, you traveled up and down the state. You did a lot of Q&As. So what did you take away from that? I mean, what were the voters most concerned with in your encounters with them?
Well, I wanted to keep people engaged, and there's so much going on, so much poverty, so much homelessness. The climate's going really bad, and we're talking about the most liberal blue state. You know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
I'm pointing out that if this is the most liberal blue state, why are we in such a mess? Because it's a systemic issue. It's bigger than blue or red. And so I'm not trying to get us into the red side. What I'm trying to do is get us to think more, as I would say, even green. The idea being that we should have a Green New Deal, that we should have not just a good environment around us, but also the political social environment that is just, you know, that's equitable. I'm resurrecting all these issues that many of us have been struggling for generations, but also really popped up after the George Floyd murders, you know, the resetting of our system, the reimagining of everything. That's kind of what I wanted to engage people with.
And the people that you talked to, what was their response? I mean, I saw some videos that looked enthusiastic to me, but go ahead.
Yeah, they were everywhere I went, people were enthusiastic. They were very happy to see that somebody's speaking these issues. I think what's happening is a lot of people are getting very cynical, and they're getting tired. They vote, nothing happens. The politicians they go for don't come through. And I get it, and I know that's really hard because I'm just another one, a guy coming along, and they're going to say, well, what makes you different? I was trying to inspire the idea that it can be different. I'm not in it for the money. I don't have corporate donations. This is why there's no way I was going to win because this is big money. All these elections, especially at the big level, governors and presidents and senators, big, big money. But I did want to make the point that we need to challenge regardless, even if it's just our numbers growing. For example, I think I've gotten close to 125,000 votes. That's pretty significant. And
yeah, it is.
I was able to become like fourth in LA County. LA County is the largest county in the country. It's bigger than 42 states in the United States. It's a big, important population center of the whole country, and I was able to get fourth there for governor. I think that's pretty significant. That's why I look at it. I don't look at it like I'm seventh out of 26 because that's where I ended up at so far right now. I'm looking at it as there's bigger things that we were trying to do. San Francisco, I got third out of 26. And so I think the issue is, can we speak to these issues that very few people, the mass media doesn't want to cover, both parties are trying to avoid, and can we bring more people along? Is it a grassroots, organized building thing that we can get out of all this?
Yeah, well, the point you made about cynicism, you know, we see in social media every place else, vote, vote, vote. And if your vote does not produce results, that is what makes people cynical. I think that's what you were talking about.
Yeah.
People
and
don't want to vote. They say,
point.
I voted before
and
nothing happened. Why should I vote again?
Yeah, it's an inept, corrupt space. But I also tell people, those that have these ideas, those that really want to revolutionize everything, like everything I do is about revolutionizing. If it's revolutionizing poetry or revolutionizing the arts or revolutionizing whatever I get involved with, there's revolution in there. And then I think we need to occupy those spaces that are also inept and corrupt. You know what I'm saying? I don't think we should turn them over to these corporations. I don't think we should just say, well, I'm walking away. It's no good. I think we got to be in there the best way we can. And that's where I wanted to get people thinking about who can start voicing these things and really building on them, because I don't think it's just about getting the message. It's actually trying to build something from this.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to weigh in with anything, Raphael? I know you have some things.
No, I was just thinking. I like the attitude. I mean, how do you think the younger voters see you when they see you coming out there and, you know, that you're at least making an attempt to be governor when most people don't even try?
Yeah, I think the young people really are probably the most cynical, which is the saddest thing about our culture. When you're young, you should be idealistic. You should have a lot of hope. But they're really getting rammed. As you know, every day something new pops up. We're in a strange country and a strange time. And young people who are, I think, have the most far-sighted ideas, from what I can tell, I'm not saying just them, but most of them are getting crushed, you know, with the weight of the Republicans and Democrats and the weight of the corporations, big money, and what the Supreme Court does and all these other people, what Biden doesn't do. Everybody, they're being crushed, but I don't want to snuff out that fire, you know. Young people were enthused that somebody like me was running, and I want that to keep going because, you know, I've been at this a long time, and I want them to be at it a long time. There's a short-term and long-term end of what I do. And I want them to be struggling all the way to the old guy like me, you know, that he still got passion. He still has fire in him. You know, I'm not a young person, so I don't pretend to be, but I do carry the kind of elder fire that I think is important that we're missing in the culture overall.
Well, yeah, because we need exemplary elders, and I think you really fit that bill, Luis, because you have always your integrity is unquestionable. You speak from the cuff. You speak directly and you speak honestly, and I think that is something that really appeals to young people, and I think that is why we need people like you, who are like that, to keep people going. I mean, to keep kids going, because, you know, otherwise they see some old guy in a suit who mumbles platitudes and it turns them off.
Yeah, and everybody's lying. You know, I mean, they can't trust any politician. They can't trust their own churches. They can't, everybody you're supposed to trust, you can't trust anymore. And their teachers, you can't even trust them. And I'm not saying all teachers, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm just letting you know that there's a lot of misrepresentation in the world. I look at these schools and I think these kids are still being taught some of the nonsense that when I was growing up I knew was nonsense. And they're still being told things and it's just a bunch of lies and misrepresentation. So I think at a certain point the young people start saying, who's telling the truth here? And honestly, I don't think it's hard. People say, well, you can't tell the truth from the truth now, because I think you can't just be truthful. You know, just say things the way they are. I don't need to be yelling and screaming, which is one thing I don't do, but I do get very passionate about what the issues are. I do get very concerned and angry without losing the language. You know what I'm saying? It's very important to have that language, the words to say these things.
I think it's important. I noticed when you talk about young people, because I got a dishwashing job and I'm kind of like the oldest one there, and I noticed the young kids, they're not engaged. They talk about movies. They don't talk about reading books. They talk about, you know, like getting, you know, freaking gummies that they're going to chew with marijuana and getting high, and just there's no goals. There's no search for knowledge. And I know when talking to Irene DeAnda, she talked about working, you know, to help your thing. That's a different generation because she's involved in, she's been schooled in intellectual stuff, but most of the kids that I work with, there's nothing. There's video games and they don't have that much knowledge.
Yeah, that's by design. I feel that that's what in general, what the schools have done, what TV, the mass media has done. It's by design to keep, especially young people from being that volatile, revolutionary-minded, dreamy, but also practical leaders that we need. You know, just keeping them out of things, isolating them. That's why a lot of young people are so isolated. They're sitting in front of their video games or their social media. They don't connect anymore, and suicide rates are going really high among them. You know, the opioid rates are going crazy with these young people. They're just not finding. They're lost, and it seems to me that this is all by design. But the ones that are engaged, I'm trying to keep engaged and maybe also pick up some more young people. I do believe that young people are important and powerful, but we do got to help. We got to guide them, teach them. We got whatever we got to do. I don't mean we got to scream at them or tell them what to do. Like I tell people, I'm not trying to say as an elder that I should lead anything. I think I'd rather walk next to them, walk with them as we go forward into the future.
Yeah.
That to me is the way to go. Yeah.
Well, you're also a writer, a fiction writer, memorist, and poet, and you've taught poetry and writing in the prisons, and it seems to me that a way of engaging with young people is to encourage their creativity in whatever. I mean, everybody is creative in one way or another.
Right.
You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to do it perfectly,
right.
But you do have. Everybody has some desire to create, and I think that. With Tia Chucha's Cafe Cultural, that is an oasis out there in the valley that encourages that sort of thing.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's so important to me because I think that creativity is one of the things that by design is being pushed out the door or it's being incorporated. You can be creative if you work for some corporation, if you work for some company, if you, you know, you can get hired to do creative things, but it's never about the things you care about. It's never about your own gifts, your own passions. It's never about what needs to be done. So I think about the language and poetry is so important because to me, that's how we keep these ideas alive. People have ideas and sometimes they can't even express it. I think most people can figure out something's wrong here and they can probably figure out which way to go. They just don't always have the idea of how to get there. You know how that goes. And I find that that's what's important. Keep the language. Poetry to me is so powerful because it's so rich in imagery, so rich in metaphor and rhythm, which keeps language alive and keeps the music in words. And I that's why I even in prisons I try to help with that because the most traumatized people are sometimes the ones that don't always have a language and don't know what to do with it. So they tend to speak enraged or tend to speak enraged. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like when you give people guns that can't speak, but they're hurting. Some of them, not all of them, but some of them will use those guns to speak for them.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, I immediately thought of the Herman Melville novelette, Billy Budd, where Billy Budd is a sailor and he is inarticulate, and he has been the second in command of the ship has been riding him and has been on his case, but he has no way of expressing himself. So he turns around and smacks the guy and kills him.
Yeah,
because he lacks the words to tell what is bothering him.
I think the silences of our culture are the ones that we don't talk about. People are screaming, yelling everywhere, but the silences are extensive. Silent, a lot of silence in the world, especially with young people. And usually it's the ones that yell and scream that you pay attention to, but the ones that are trying to be invisible, that don't want to be seen, that are scared to be seen or don't know if they should be seen are the ones that explode. And so I always think that we got to give language as much as possible, as far wide as possible. And that's what's missing, like I say, when you think about these young people. A lot of mass students aren't young people, but many of them are. And you think about those that, and I'm not trying to excuse anybody, but you think about people thinking, this is how I'm going to be seen. This is how I'm going to be heard. Just kill a whole mess of people. Of course, there's a level of detachment that I think is also cultural. You know, level of detachment where you don't care because that's also part of the culture. We're getting detached all the time. We're constantly being disconnected from relations, from our peers, the good peers, healthy things, and we react that kind of way. So I think this is why creativity and community is important right now, to build it, to make it strong, to make the arts transformative, not just a nice thing to do, but to transform lives and communities.
You actually made me think of something, because I mean, there's a progression with the homeless where back in the 30s, they actually let people come in to sleep during the cold and the rain. Now it's to the point where people can just walk by a homeless person and not care. They're just there.
Yeah.
And like invisible.
And when the heat comes in there and they're dying of heat, very few people are out crying. There's no outcry.
Yep.
When when people were being, you could see them in the streets. At first, there was an outcry in the beginning, but after a while, it gets so normalized that now you don't think about it. You don't care. And if they're all out there on drugs or getting mentally ill, because they're not necessarily started off mentally ill, you can get mentally ill after enough experiences like that. But the point is, after a while, we don't even care. We just think, well, let's push them away, or let's put them in prisons, or if they die, you know, people start thinking that way. That's where I think it's where we're at, and why people
If there is outcry, people that are doing the outcry, like, as soon as they find out that the shelter's going to be there and near their home, well, we don't want it here.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like...
That's true, and that's another part of the detachment. These aren't our neighbors. You know, that's what happens when you create borders, and then you create more borders and more borders. Now we got borders in our own neighborhoods, our own houses, our own families. Now I got borders between me and others. You know what I'm saying? People can't see the humanity in other people. A border comes along. Now these poor people are trying to get over because they can't live in their own countries for problems that we created. Now we can't see them as humans anymore. You know, it just keeps piling on all the inhumanity that we keep. And I'm not talking about the really bad people. I'm talking about good people. I'm talking about good Americans. You know, I think that one of the key things that I learned from watching this insurrection thing, January 6th, wasn't so much that it was an extremist. It was extreme up to a point, but that there was a lot of quote-unquote good Americans among them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Good,
yeah.
Hardworking business owners, people that had kids. They said the majority were like over 30 years old, more stable, and they're out there tearing up the Capitol. And you think, this is not the extreme this is good old America, you know, going crazy, and that's what people aren't seeing.
Well, one thing seems to me that is crucially important these days is to have a space where people can go.
Yeah.
And that's why I wanted to return to Tia Chucha's Cafe Cultural, because that is a space, and we need more of those kind of spaces.
Yeah, I wish we had one in every neighborhood. Tia Chucha's, for those who don't know, and you can look it up online, TIACHUCHA.org, is such a, like you say, it is an oasis. We're in a strip mall, which has regular strip mall things, in a community, Somar, which is, you know, working class, lower working class. You know, there's a few nice ranches on the outskirts, but mainly it's just poor working class people just trying to survive like everybody else. It's got a lot of crystal meth problems, a lot of suicides, you know, a lot of problems with kids. And yet here's a center that really draws on them, gets them, and not only that, draws the art out of them, draws the love that they have, their gifts, whatever these young people have. I have a great staff of young people that are running Tia Chucha's right now. Me and my wife worked 20 years to create this space and train these young people, and they're doing a great job. And there's books, man. They don't have any bookstores in the whole Northeast Valley. 500,000 people. There was no art galleries. There was no really comprehensive cultural spaces. There was no movie houses here. And here we have a space where people can come, can express themselves. Our open mics are opening up again after more than 2 years of the pandemic. We had to close them down. People are coming back. We got music workshops. We got dance, theater. We got just a lot of philosophy workshops. Just a lot of young people. And everybody's invited. So we got some of their parents. We got little kids too. But it's mainly these youths that are like coming alive, you know, with music and art and theater and writing. That, to me, is what's important.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's very important. I want to bring up how we met. I mean, I met you through Sandy Taylor at the Latino Family Festival, I think, in 94.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
And it was because of Sandy Taylor, because Sandy Taylor told me that I should meet you. And I just want to say that Sandy Taylor was a great mentor, I think, to the both of us.
He, you know what, I feel bad he's passed. I will have to say Sandy Taylor is really one of these great human beings. There's a lot of them out there. You two are two of them, too. that you have to honor. I mean, he opened the door for some guy like me. He didn't have to do nothing. He liked what I was about. He supported my early work. I had people like Martin Spada and Jack Hirschman that were also, they were all published by Sandy Taylor, and they stood up for me with him, and he put so much behind my work. I wouldn't have gotten anywhere with Always Winning without Sandy Taylor. Him and Judith Doyle, you know, from Kirkstone Press out of Connecticut, they sacrificed a lot to make sure Always Winning was going to be seen, and it opened all kinds of doors that I don't even think we could imagine. Simon Schuster opened did the paperback and all kinds of places that we went. I decided to quit all my work when Soul Was Winning first came out. I was working in all these jobs, and I was working in news radio, and I quit everything just to dedicate to pushing Always Winning. So I ended up, the first 3 months, we hit 40 cities. Sandy Taylor organized all of that. We got to be a big thing. I got to be a Good Morning America, Oprah Winfrey, Entertainment Weekly. It opened up worlds I couldn't even imagine. A lot of it had to do with the year before my book came out, the LA uprising that happened. So now people were interested. What's up with LA gangs? What's up with LA youth? What's up with LA? Yeah. And I had a book. Even though I was living in Chicago at the time, my book was about LA. So, Sandy Taylor was one of those amazing, powerfully wonderful human beings that unfortunately did pass. And I appreciate that, Rafael, because he was a mentor to many people, and I'm glad that you could say he was your mentor, because he guided me. And there's no way that I could ever repay back the kind of love and support he gave to my work.
Well, Luis, if I may say so, I believe you are paying that back by mentoring other people and passing that on.
Yep.
What you got from him, you've been passing on. And there's no question that is... that's like a lineage that has to be preserved.
Well, that's important for people to know. I mean, I've been fortunate to have mentors like that. Like I said, I mentioned Jack Hirschman. I mentioned all these people, Martin Espada and others who I can't even name them all. There's so many that were there for me. I thought when I was in a Chicano that I was going to get all these Chicanos pissed off because I'm a new up-and-coming writer and who's going to care. But everybody stepped up to help me. Jimmy Santiago Baca, Juan Felipe Herrera, Sandra Cisneros, Ana Castillo, they all were there. Lend me a hand, Victor Villaseñor, all these writers that were already made it, you know, already like the Chicano writers, you know what I'm saying? Jose Montoya, too, before he passed, was a great teacher and friend. I'm fortunate to have him, so I like you say, I got to give back. I got to do the same things, like say, pay it forward. I got to help others. I got to open doors, and that's why I started the Atruta Press, to help. Initially, the new emerging writers, we've gotten a lot of great writers come out of there. We've got great anthologies. We've published more than 100 books over the last 33 years. I don't have the kind of publishing house where I do a lot of books a year. I usually do about 2-3 books a year, but we put a lot of love behind there, and it's still going, and we've opened doors for a lot of young voices. I was just event with Louis Red Resto here in L.A. that we gave her first two books was with the Atucha Press. It's a powerful poet and voice. And I just did an event with Claudia Castro Luna, the Salvadorian writer from Washington State. We just published her book, just came out. These new voices, these women, these powerful marginalized people that become center to who we are and what our culture is. And that's my way, one of the ways I give back, just to help others. To me, it's people help me, I got to do that to others.
Well, it's an excellent press, and for our listeners, you can go to the Teachucha website and check out what they've got there. And is there a website for the press with all of the publications, or can they find that at Teachucha's as well?
You can go to the website, and then there's a page for Teachucha Press, but also just go to our bookstore, and you can look up all our books. You can order all our books there at our own website.
And listeners, that is the way supporting small presses is really important, because they are the ones that are going to give voice to the voiceless, to the people that are usually marginalized or passed over by the big corporate presses. So as I've said before, whenever I've reviewed a book here, go and buy that book from directly from the publisher or from your local independent bookstore. If possible, mm-hmm. skip Amazon. They take a big chunk away. Mm-hmm. Go directly
yeah.
to the publisher or your independent bookstore. So, and those of you who
yeah,
are listening out there in the San Fernando Valley, it's not a big trip to get out to Teachuches and Sylmar. We have the public transportation is much improved from back in the day, so it's worth checking out.
Yeah, that's right. And even though we're kind of like in, and you can't even say the sticks because we're highly urbanized out there in the Northeast Valley, but we're at the very end of LA City. Which, you know, no people know that this part of the valley, most of the valley, is still Los Angeles City. You know, because I even hear people say, oh, L.A.'s down over there, like downtown. I go, well, you know, you're in L.A. City here. They don't even know. But it still is. And Sylmar is like the last community before you get into other county communities. But we're here, and it's very important community. And we also work with all communities because the Achuchas goes to events all over South L.A., East L.A., other parts of the valley. We go as far as wide as we can for festivals and whatever we can do to help.
What have you got coming up, Luis?
Well, me personally, it's kind of like now that the campaign is finished, we're talking about trying to organize those voices that came out of those votes. Like I said, about 125,000 votes so far. What do we do with that? I don't want to just say, hey, I got those votes and walk away. I think those are people that were trying to do something special and different against great odds. Vote for somebody that didn't have any money, didn't have any media, but yet they knew represented what they were about. So we're thinking about either an institution or some kind of way to keep working with people like that. I'm also, believe it or not, working on other media. I'm working on a big movie script. I've been trying to get into the Hollywood side, which is even more inept and corrupt, you know. But it's like I said, all these spaces, we have to try to get in there. So I'm trying to tell these stories that they won't tell. And I'm getting some inroads, you know. This, you never know. Always Running, for example, I've been trying to get into Hollywood for the last 30 years. It's been one terrible situation after another, but I'm still trying to do it on my terms. I don't care about the big money because people say, well, you offer a lot of money, buy your rights, and then they'll do whatever they want with it. I don't care about that. I want the right story to be told the right way. So I'm still working. So I'm working on a script right now that I hope will get going. Kind of based on Always Running, but one aspect that we're taking and building up on it. I'm also working, believe it or not, on 4 books. I have a poetry book. I got a story collection. Trying to do this novel. I'm trying to do another book of essays. I just have to keep writing. And then, of course, I'm traveling all over. I'll be in Chicago in a couple of weeks doing the work I do there. We're going to do a big giant restorative justice conference. I'll be leading one of the workshops there. And, I just got to keep doing what I'm doing. It's like I told people, you know, I'm past retirement age, you know. I get Social Security, which helps. It's not much.
Sure.
But I'm not retiring. I'm refiring. That's what I keep saying, you know.
Yeah,
it's just,
that's good.
I'm coming. Yeah, it's important to stay active and relevant.
I have to say that when you were Poet Laureate of Los Angeles, you set the bar really high. I mean, I don't think anybody has matched you who's had the office since then. In terms of the appearances that you made, the workshops that you held, it was the best.
I had a lot of fun, man. I mean, so it's one of the things, if you're going to do Poet Laureate, have fun at it. And I got all over the place. You know, Los Angeles area is a great poetry community. It's underrated as far as people don't know it that well. You know, there's great communities all over L.A., I mean, the country, you know, New York and San Francisco, Chicago, they all got great poetry communities. But L.A., to me, is very singular and very powerful and very extensive. Great poets, great literature, great writers, even great bookstores. You know, L.A.'s got a lot that people don't give it credit for. Glad to tap into all these communities that nobody thinks about. And I was all over the place. That's the way it should be. And I don't expect other poet laureates to do what I did, but I do think whatever they do, have fun and make poetry come alive for the communities.
What young poets do you like that have been coming out recently? Because I know several young poets that me and Richard talked to helped with your campaign.
Yeah, so really, we had these poets for Luis come up up and down the state in San Francisco, and we had it in Fresno and Sacramento, other places in L.A. Flower Song Press, I have to say, is doing some amazing work with some of these writers. And so,
oh,
as
yeah.
you know, Matt Cedillo is out there. He's doing powerful. His work is powerful. David Romero, who's also part of Flower Song Press, Brianna Munoz, not only is she a great poet, a great voice, she was very strong in my campaign. All of them actually had a role helping me. There's so many good, strong voices popping out all over L.A. that I would just say, go to the open mics, go to these readings. Flower Song Press is almost everywhere, and they're doing readings all over the place. Go check them out. Ed Miliwarde is doing this great publishing house out of Texas. He's an L.A. guy, but
yeah, we interviewed
work
him. We talked to him. We talked to him on the show. Yeah.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, that's some great work. So, yeah, I'm supporting all these young people. They're just putting it out there, man. They're powerful voices.
Well, I like their, I love their, how real they are and how they really believe in what they're talking about. Because you can tell it's not dishonest.
Right, and that's to me. It's what they're authentic. They got the combination of the page and the stage, and they're really saying some powerful things about the world that we're in, which I always thought was important. They have personal poems. I mean, obviously that's important, but they
sure.
also connect with what's going on in this world. And to me, that's the kind of voices we need.
Well, yeah, I mean, Iris DeAndo and Brianna Munoz, I've read both their books, and they're both powerful because they have personal stuff, but they also have stuff where they talk about what's going on in the world.
Yeah, and to me that's always important because there used to be a big move against people that spoke about stuff in the world, and they would call them didactic or political poets and everything else. And I think poetry is a dynamic that can touch everything. Every subject could be touched and given a poetic sense to it, you know, but don't say this is not the material for poetry. Everything is material for poetry, especially what's going on in our world, especially now, the way things are going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I like the fact that, you know, you could have different genres. I mean, because every poetry is poetry, and when somebody chooses to write about it, you have a writer like Fred Voss who just writes about being a machinist, but it's still good poetry. But at the same time, I like my bringing up Fred is because he brings you into a world that you're never going to be in. Just like when you write about Always Running, you're talking about a life that people are never going to live, but they're trying to get an understanding about it from
yeah.
these books that are written.
Well, you know, I grew up at a time when you know, in the 60s, where all those great books were coming out. And, you know, when Malcolm X came out and James Baldwin, yeah. but even Ken Casey and Kurt Vonnegut and all these great voices were really big. You know what I'm saying? Even though some of those guys wrote earlier, but they were very important, Nelson Algren. I was reading all these great writers, man. I don't know where some of them are nowadays. I'm sure they're there. Like I said, there's some new voices that are coming up, but I grew up at a good time where people were writing some good, heavy stuff about the world, and I learned from them. And I always thought what I loved about them is they were poets, but they also, some of them wrote plays, and some of them wrote essays, and some of them wrote scripts. And, you know, in other words, they had multi-genre expression
wow.
of what they were going through. And I learned that around the world, most people do that. Like Pablo Neruda is my favorite poet, but he's also a great essayist. He's also a great playwriter.
Mm-hmm.
He's also written, you know, memoir. He's written, you know, he's done so many other works that it's like, we're the only country where people tell you if you're a poet, stay a poet. Or
yeah.
if you're a social
well, yeah.
story writer, don't do this, don't do that. But I really love that people can find different expressions in literature for what they need to say. But you got to be good at all that stuff. I mean, that's the tricky part. You have to be good at poetry, and then if you're going to do a novel, be good at writing a novel. You know, just really learn the craft and get
into
it.
Oh, yeah, no,
so I made that my point, yeah, to make sure I was good, or pretty much as much as I could in whatever I was doing.
No, that makes sense. I mean, it's like when Michelle Cera transitioned to a young adult novel, then she ended up working on George Lopez's show. But she kept evolving. She didn't just stay one thing. But she still wrote poetry, but she kept moving.
There you go. Evolving, I think, is the right word. We all can evolve, and we can be good at all these things. You know, and people make fun of people who have mastery of different things. They say they're master of none, but I don't think that's true. Mastery is mastery.
No.
But I agree with one thing you said, Rafael. We have to allow the voices and those expressions to be seen or heard, even when there is no mastery. Just get out there. Just do it. Stumble through your art, but do it, man. Get out there and make your mistakes. I started that way. Before Sandy Taylor and others paid attention to me, I had the worst poetry you can imagine. But that's how you start. Nobody starts off like, well, maybe a few
start off with great poets,
but most of them don't. But you keep at it. You evolve. You get better. You meet other people. You read tons of books, which is another important thing. That's why I have a bookstore. I think people should read books all the time. And you read and you study and you look at people and you learn from them and you do evolve. We're constantly getting better. Then there's mastery coming through all these works. And I have found that to be important. Mastery shouldn't be just the purview of the most educated or the most privileged. Anybody could be a master. And if you go to the poorest community, you see masters all the time. You know?
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes. Well, my parents were... Oh, go ahead, Rafael. I wanted to quickly make the point that my parents were children of the Depression. My father's formal education ended at the seventh grade. My mother graduated from high school. But between them, they spoke four languages, and they were autodidacts because of their lack of formal education. I mean, growing up, I mean, they read books. That was basically their fun.
Right. Well, a lot of those guys that we mentioned didn't start off getting books written by academic presses. They started writing them, you know, and then they just got better at them. That's what I loved about the 60s. There was some raw stuff coming out, you know what I mean? And I'm seeing it now. I'm seeing it with Flower Song Press. I'm seeing raw but beautiful, powerful things, and they need to be said. The rawness is not the problem. Again, the more you do it, and you'll evolve, as you say. You'll get better, and that's always good. But the rawness has also got some power in it, too, you know.
Well, I think it's kind of the intensity, the emotion that comes out of some of the raw written words.
I noticed that sometimes when you're young and you're raw, you put out more good stuff, and then sometimes you get older, you kind of blunt the edges. And I say, well, that maybe they learned the wrong thing, you know. But you got to stay strong. You know who was very raw, but I know I'm kind of weird this way, but I actually like Charles Bukowski. A lot of people don't like him. I mean, he's attacked all over the place. I read Charles Bukowski in a library. I walked into a library, read his work. I started reading Charles Bukowski everywhere. I was reading it. Some of that stuff was really raw. But he had a poetic... What redeemed him, I understand he personally was a pretty rotten guy. That's what I understand. You know, but he redeemed himself through his poetry, whatever he was. There was moments in some of his works that were just like, dude, you know, you hit at it. And he had a rawness that was also refined when he got to his poetic moments, you know. And so I think that's important for people to feel... I mean, I know people like George Bukowski drink all the time. They treat women badly and everything, but they don't do poetry. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And at least if you're a poet, you got something that some of these issues can be addressed, looked at. He was struggling with himself as a human being through his poetry. And it spoke to people like me, especially a young poet who didn't know what he was doing, who was struggling through it with addictions and you know, in and out of a lot of trouble in relationships. He could speak to some guy like me and make me think that maybe I could do something like that.
Well, I have to tell you this story, Luis. When I was going to high school, there used to be this bookstore on Fulton Avenue and I think Burbank. It was across the street from Valley Community College. It was called the Dialogue Bookshop, and I used to go in there because it had all of the underground papers and lots of great stuff.
Right.
And that's where I first saw Bukowski's poetry. And I had read him in the Los Angeles Free Press. He used to have a column called Notes of a Dirty Old Man.
Right.
And then I saw there was a flyer for a poetry reading that he was going to be at. So I went to this poetry reading, which it turned out to be at somebody's house. And I didn't know what Bukowski looked like. I'd never seen a picture of him. But when we got there, there was this guy who was sitting on the floor, leaning against the wall, and he had a six-pack of Brew 102 between his legs. And that, for people who are not familiar with L.A., this was a local beer that was like, you know, $1 a six-pack back in the day.
Right. Yeah.
So, and this guy was opening cans and swigging, and some people read, and then the host said, and our next reader is Charles Bukowski. Now, next to him, he had a Webcore reel-to-reel tape recorder that was plugged in. So when his name was announced, he pushed a button, and we listened to his pre-recorded poems while he kept his drinks.
Wow.
Yeah. And then after it was all over, I actually went up to him, and I said, Mr. Bukowski, what do you need to know to be a good poet? And he looked up at me and he said, kid, you have to know how to drive all the horses at once. And of course, at that point, I wasn't sure what he was talking about. But later on, I figured, well, you have to know what you want to say, how you want to say it, what words you want to use, who you want to reach.
Yeah.
So that's what I figured that he was talking about. Those are the horses that you have to know how to drive.
Yeah, wow, what a character. I mean, you don't find people like that, and I'm not saying that that's something to emulate, but it's just something,
a
singular character like that. Yeah, but his poetry, you know, he's actually, I understand, the most popular poet in the United States.
Hmm.
So something is there that opens doors for people. Maybe people like us who are kind of down and out, you know what I'm saying? I don't know the other word to say it.
Yeah.
He could speak to that. I don't want to be that kind of person, obviously, because to me it's not healthy. I can't do that. Drinking, and those days are gone, and I can't do that. But it did open the door for a young person like me.
When I was coming up, people learned to Bukowski, but I think they missed the whole point of what he was wanting to do. Bukowski wanted to come out of, you know, Skid Row. And a lot of these young poets were going to Skid Row and drinking and trying to be Bukowski, emulate him. But to me, to emulate Bukowski, it would be to get out of there and move forward. Because he didn't want to stay in Skid Row. He wanted to move forward. I mean, and to me, that's his example.
Right.
He survived it. He survived his father. He survived all that abuse to become something.
Yeah.
And that is what the young poets didn't see when I was coming up. And they would all try to write like him and try to be like him and go to Skid Row for some reason.
Well, there's, of course, you know, a lot of people miss a certain aspect of his work that you also have, Lewis, because he wrote from the position of a working man. He wrote about work as well as drinking and chasing women. He wrote about, you know, doing actual work. He was a wage worker.
Yeah.
And that was
important for me. Yeah. Because I was actually, when I started coming around the poetry scene in L.A., you know, and I used to come around Brooke in the late 70s, I was working in industry, you know, and there wasn't too many of me there. And I would show up to these readings around L.A., and there wasn't a lot of working class people there, but I was one of them. I used to work at Bethlehem Steel, you know, and I used to work at the St. Regis Paper Mill, and I used to work at oil refineries. I did a lot of work, but I was doing poetry. And I remember that Bukowski was writing about the work, the post office work that he did, just being a working stiff. That also spoke to me.
Yeah.
And made me think, gee, man, he can do this. And, you know, his language was very common, but also very rich. He wasn't just, you know, he had a thing with language. And that was one of those guys too, because I was also drinking too much and, you know, doing everything else too much, partying too much. But just knowing that there could be a working class person to do poetry and to excel beyond the limitations of the life you've been given, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That to me was an important part of his story.
Yeah, that's what I try to get from him, you know, and all the poems that he wrote about were like trying to, they were, to me, he was trying to move forward, not backward.
Yeah, I agree. I think he was. I mean, everybody's evolving. Even he was evolving. And maybe he didn't quite evolve the way I did, but he evolved. And his poetry was constantly moving him through that spiral of life. In many ways, that's what's happened with me. My writing and my work has moved me through. I'm moving in a different direction maybe, but still it's powerful to know that you can do that.
Yeah.
That's what's important of people like that. That's why I say the poetry redeems even the worst kind of individual, you know. But poetry has that power.
Yeah.
The other
thing that I liked about him is that he turned his caustic vision onto himself from time to time.
Well, that's one very important point. I think despite everything, he was honestly pointing to himself. You know, maybe that's what spoke to me. He didn't just climb a high horse. You know, he was constantly talking about the fucked upness of himself and relationships.
Yeah, exactly. Well, some people sort of miss them. Some people sort of pick up on he was old blue collar macho man type of thing. Well, that wasn't true because I remember the first time I read this poem. I forget the name of it, but the situation is he's going to meet this woman in a motel for sex. So he goes to the motel and they meet up and she looks at him and says, "Oh, you don't look so good." And he says, "Well, neither do you." And he says, "Let's get going." And so he undresses and he takes his clothes off and he says to the woman, he says, "Look, for every inch you don't see, for every inch you see, there's six you don't." And the woman answers back, "Well, there better be because I only see an inch." So, I mean, no macho man would put that into a poem.
He was totally crass, but you know another writer that I loved a lot was John Fante, and Charles Bukowski used to really talk about John Fante. So I read all John Fante's books, and I remember *As the Dust*, which is a powerful, important book about.
One
of the classics, and I tell and people have told me, "How can you like John Fante? He was a racist. He hated Mexicans." But I go read John Fante. He hated Mexicans. He hated his life. And what was interesting is that there would be these passages where he would make fun of the Mexicans around him, and then he falls in love with this Mexican girl, right?
Yeah.
And then he realizes he doesn't deserve her. And then he talks about how the Mexicans were these Aztec princesses on the streets and how beautiful they were. He was really knocking himself down. He was a white guy who hated himself. You know what I'm saying? And people kept thinking that because a lot of that hate turned into, "I got to hate others." There was an authenticity in their voices that people sometimes miss. It's hard. It's probably nuanced. It may not seem that way because it can be very crass, but keep reading.
Yeah.
And then you see where they get to that human seed, that human ball that's inside of them, that's dying inside. That's what I loved about those writers. And John Fante was another one of these guys. I got John Fante, you know. I got what he was dealing with, you know.
It just made me think of something from my time when I was away, like my 3 years. There's this guy named Blockhead who took care of me. He was a white supremacist, but he liked me.
Yeah.
And he put me in his cell to keep me from being beat up. But the point is, he was racist, but the thing is, what I realized about him when he took this guy out, he just knocked him out of commissary. And he goes, "What did I tell you? I told you the old man gets your bunk. You don't let our old in the lower in the top bunk. He's not going to climb. You need to take care of him." So I see a whole bunch of liberal people, you know, talk about racism and stuff, but some of the most liberal people treat their own family really bad. So, you know.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. You know, I've had those experiences. I'll just tell one really quickly. And not only in jails, because I worked in these prisons and I met all kinds of people. 40 years, I met amazing people. But one of them was a guy that, when I met him, a white guy, he was a really powerful writer, really sweet guy. He helped open the the first honor yard in the state of California, where integrated yard, where you can be all races. It was actually very successful. It was so successful that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger closed it down. You know how that goes. Yeah. He didn't like it. He said these people don't deserve honor. Don't call it honor yard. They opened it up as a progressive yard or something, a programming yard. But my point was, when I knew him, he was a great human being. And then somebody tells me that he did 38 years in prison, this guy. And then somebody tells me, you know, he used to be a racist skinhead type. He killed a man, homeless guy, when he was 19 years old. This guy was terrible. And I go, well, I'm sure that's true, but I want to tell you the man that I met in my classes, a full, wonderful, decent human being. I'm sure he did those things, and I'm sure he's capable of it. Yeah. But I also saw the kind of changes that were possible, and I know could be even more possible if people could pay attention to all these things. So he became a lifelong friend, this guy. He eventually got out. We got him out. He had life without possibility of parole. We got the then Governor Brown to commute his sentence. And he got out, and he's doing great. He's out there speaking to people. He's working with a bunch of formerly incarcerated. He's doing a lot of great work. But I think your point off, and I think it's a good one, is you can't write anybody else off. Sometimes, yeah, like they say, what you see is not what you get. I get it. There's some racist fools that are racist and no good. No matter what you do, they don't get anywhere. But there's more to it that people don't see and don't understand. And a lot of it is just, yeah.
Well, the funny thing about that story, I was being beat up by a Salvadorian for not praying. I didn't want to pray because I didn't want to be a hypocrite. So he's beating me up for not praying. So Blockhead found out about that, and he had me moved to his cell.
Yeah, well, that's the world that you're in. You have to do a lot of things. Yeah. But that's how you get to see how humanity is. It's not what people think it is.
No, you learn.
If all they listen to is what the fantasies that the media gives you, you don't really get a full sense of what's really going on in the prisons or among the homeless or anything, you know.
You know, I had this one cellmate, Ed, wanted me to write a poem for his daughter because he didn't know how to tell her he loved her. And he goes, she wrote him back. I know you didn't write this, Dad, but I appreciate the effort.
Yeah. Well, that's an important part. I mean, you know, a lot of those guys, at least I knew, didn't have relationships with their kids. And it's hard. And they don't know what to do about it. And it's better for them to detach, because the more attached they get, the more emotionally rot they get. And people don't understand that. So, well, how can you detach from your parent kids? But there's a reason for it. And it's horrible, but that happens. And hopefully, like you say, get them to the point where they can maybe just be honest and real with their kids, even if they tell you to drop dead. You know, you still got to try to do that, you know.
And I was happy that she actually wrote him back.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's great. Those are the kind of experiences that,
yeah. What? No, poetry is powerful. You don't realize how powerful it is until you find a way to use it to help people.
Yeah, and I think it all helps people. And this is why I give the poetry... I do whatever I can to bring poetry out of anybody, everybody, everywhere. Even when I'm dealing with traumatized kids, and I'm not saying they shouldn't go get therapy, they shouldn't get the help, but I always tell them, write. You'd be surprised how writing becomes therapy if you know what you're doing. I don't want to substitute for any help. Yeah. But it can help open up a lot of things. And in many ways, as you know, over the years now, real therapists, I mean, therapists who go to school now use writing, use art. Now it's part of people's therapy plans. Yeah, because they realize the power of it. We were doing it without knowing all that, but now some of them are realizing, hey, this is important ways to get through some of these issues. It's true. It's true, man.
Well,
yeah.
I think that to return to Always Running for a moment, it seems to me that it's a modern classic, and by that I mean it was written something like 30 years ago, or published 30 years ago.
Yeah.
roughly, and it is still in print. It is still timely. People still read it, still talk about it, and that's what makes it classic. So,
thank you. No, I know, and I'm kind of surprised, but it is. And there's two things about that. That means that people are looking for books that can speak to reality versus books that just totally don't. But the other side of it is that I hope someday a book like Always Running becomes obsolete. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the only way it becomes obsolete is when those issues that I raise are gone. You know, the kind of racism and discrimination and oppression and that way people knock people down and the ways that people get traumatized and become mutated human beings, all these things have hopefully get eventually dealt with so that people don't need to keep doing it. But as long as those realities are there, we need to write about them.
That's not
absolutely.
So, Richard, do you have any more questions? Because we've had a pretty good long talk.
No, we've covered a lot, and I really
thank you for
your time, Luis.
Well, you know what? If you guys don't mind, let me end with a poem.
Sure, please do.
Wow, damn, we never brought that one up.
Yeah.
It's okay. So it's a short poem, but since we're talking about these young people, I have in one of my books a section called Poems Too Short to Braid. And I got that concept when I was doing poetry in these big, giant homeless shelters in Chicago. I used to go to these homeless shelters for the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless and do poetry workshops. And I'm talking about in Chicago, they're huge, 300 to 400 people would be in them. And I know LA's got a few of them, but not like that. It's just, you know, you got to do them in Chicago because the cold gets so bad. But there was all kinds of stuff in these shelters, and I was working with this women's shelter that the women were considered the most, the ones that would never get any, they'll never make it, they'll never have a home. They were mentally ill, or they were just had all kinds of problems, but they were some of the best poets. So we came up with this concept, Poems Too Short to Braid. So here's one of mine, and it's called The Next Generation. There is a death sentence poised above the boys, who even now straddle the razor edge of living and dying. And what of the girls? They try so hard only to end up as mothers to the fathers who mutate the daughters.
Wow.
And I just, it, you know, it's a short poem, but it says a lot.
Yeah,
it was about
it does.
What we do. Yeah, it says a lot without saying a lot. And it leaves you hanging there because that's what poetry can do. Makes you think about the depth of underneath all the words, the well of emotions that it's there underneath those words.
Yeah.
So I just thought it'd be good to leave with that to let them know what poetry can do.
Wow. Yes, well, thank you for that, Luis. That's a terrific ending.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Yeah, and actually, I want to start having some of your poets on the show. I mean, you mentioned the Salvadorian poet. I'm interested in that one.
Yeah,
talk
on
the show,
good names of people. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks for coming on the show. We just had Luis Rodriguez on the show. Please support THUE Cultural Center. Please buy his books. They're a great press, and they've done a lot for the poetry community. Anything else, Richard?
No, that's it. Thanks again, Luis.
And
all right,
thank
man.
You for listening.
Be well.
All right.
All right, we're done?
Yep.
Yeah, okay, guys, take care.